Welcome to the September 15th service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. Today, our service is led by our settled minister, Reverend Pam Phillips, assisted by worship associate Stephen Henninger. The title of Rev. Pam's sermon is Dashed Expectations.
Today's opening words are from Reverend Suzelle Lynch. We are a people of expectation, trusting that the world will deliver what we want, yet opening our hearts to a universe of beauty and struggle beyond all predication. We are a people of expectation, anticipating what we feel we deserve, but faithful in the paths unfolding, even when it leads to wilderness. As a people of expectation, we come together with hope and joy. May our time together warm our hearts and inspire our spirits.
Last week, we talked about the figments of our expectations, how we create expectations for ourselves and for others that can lead to disappointment in ourselves and in others. Today, I'd like to consider our broader expectations for the world, how we can be disappointed when circumstances much larger than our sphere of influence turn out to be much different than we anticipated, than we expected. Here again, our expectations of the world are influenced by who we are, when and where we were born and how we were raised, our social location. And as Stephen and I talked about the expectations we had for our lives, it became especially clear that coming from different generations, I figured it out, I'm twice as old as you. We have very different expectations. And so I wanted him to share his perspective with you today.
You are certain to have a better future than we have. I distinctly remember being told this, or some variation, countless times growing up by my parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, history books, and our national myths. Whether it was economic, environmental, or simply hope, there was no assumption that I would not be better off than my parents. Growing up, this expectation was enticing and hopeful. I could be who I wanted, I could study what I wanted, and I could experiment and try new things with little risk. The expectation of increased wealth, a stable environment, and a lifetime of hope was captivating and awe-inspiring. I grew up in Michigan, and the auto industry was quite literally my family's livelihood. My father worked in the auto industry. He did not go to college and taught himself everything and anything about cars, rising to a position where he oversaw the building and creation of the motors for General Motors' Corvette racing team. The reality that my father could be a self-taught expert on engine diagnostics without having any college degree was awe-inspiring. What then would my future be after going to college? The hope and expectation of a better tomorrow was astounding. Yet that expectation was dashed. When I was 16, a junior in high school, the financial crash of 2008 came. My father's company, General Motors, needed to be bailed out by the federal government. Thousands of Michiganders, some of them my friends and family, were losing their livelihoods. The uncertainty was palpable, and Thanksgiving and Christmas of that year were anything but joyous. Because of that tumultuous fall, I chose a career with financial stability, am strict with my personal budget, and worry late at night about my financial future. The expectation of financial stability is completely gone. I grew up with constant war since the age of 9, a near global financial collapse with the uncertainty of whether we are safe in our schools or our houses of worship, and the near certainty that regions of the world will be inhospitable in a few decades due to climate change. With all of this and more in my mind, how can I, after nearly 28 years of living, have an expectation of a better tomorrow? What risk do I have to the United States' birthright of a better future than my predecessors? Where can I look for hope for a better future?
My heart breaks just a little when I think about the lack of expectations for a bright tomorrow that Stephen expresses in his reflection. When young people don't have the same expectations that some of us had when we were their age, then what hope do any of us have for the future? You've heard me say before how much hope and faith I derive from being around young people. May explain why I spent 20 years as a middle school teacher. From the sweet children who join us every Sunday morning and engage with such sincerity with our service and the time for all ages. To the youth who meet every Sunday night with Why Are You You and invite me to join them once a month. To the members of the Youth Caucus at our General Assembly who enliven our business meetings with their impassioned expressions of support for social justice. This year they handed out bingo cards, so those tag words were spoken, we got to mark them off, and I got a prize. Their energy and their commitment serves as a tonic when I am feeling jaded or simply tired. But I am pretty sentimental, I admit. Last spring, I went grocery shopping on graduation day, and I started feeling verklempt and got teary-eyed seeing all the graduates who were still wearing their regalia, their caps and gowns, in the aisles of Kroger. When I think of graduates from high school and college, I think of how they're embarking on a new life and that they have all kinds of possibilities ahead of them. I'm so glad for them and a little jealous. Do you remember that feeling of having great expectations for the future? Or I may be over-sentimentalizing. I'm probably forgetting all the anxiety and fear I felt when I first started out. But I do think the world has changed dramatically since my college graduation. And I think my expectations have changed in ways similar to Stephen's. Now, many of us were raised to expect that we could take part in the American dream, defined by James Truslow Adams in 1931 this way. Life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement, regardless of social class or circumstances of birth. That's the dream Stephen was led to believe in as a child, watching his father succeed without the benefit of a college education. It's the dream many of us may have held on to for most of our lives. It's a dream reinforced by popular culture, by music and book and televisions and movies. It's the Horatio Alger rags to riches story. And while some of us may have experienced the American dream, others have not. I think about people who grew up thinking that they would get a job in a coal mine or work in a factory making cars or steel or furniture or textiles, thinking that they would be able to support a family. Do you remember those days? But now they live in a world where coal is no longer a viable source of energy because of the damage to the environment. And the high-paying factory jobs have been moved overseas. Their expectations were dashed by the new economy. And I'm not sure those of us who didn't experience that disequilibrium and disappointment understood how devastating it has been for them until the 2016 election. Politicians who promised to help those folks regain their footing in the world got their votes. And as much as they may try, I'm mindful that the good old days of good union jobs are probably never coming back. And I worry about those people who keep holding on to their expectation that they will. I think also of those who never really felt that the American dream was meant for them. Just this week in our Wednesday Conversations on Faith group, we talked about the GI Bill and how it helped returning veterans get education and housing that they would never have been able to get otherwise. And while the GI Bill itself was race neutral, conditions in the country made it really difficult, if not impossible, for many African American veterans to take advantage of it. They couldn't buy some houses, think Levittown, because of redlining. They couldn't get into many of the colleges because of segregation. And while the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s took away some of the impediments, we are becoming increasingly aware of just how many impediments to equity remain. Sometimes it's hard to believe that we'll ever attain the dream that Martin Luther King Jr. told us about in his speech at the March on Washington in 1963. But we, as Unitarian Universalists, have a long history of optimism, starting as far back as 1856, when Unitarian minister James Freeman Clark wrote about the continuity of human development in all worlds, or the progress of mankind, onward and upward forever. So that mankind part he got wrong, right? What about womankind? We are also fond of repeating the words from Martin Luther King Jr., "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice," implying that while the road may be long, it will eventually lead to justice. But it's not so simple, is it? King's words were inspired by those of Theodore Parker, a transcendentalist, abolitionist, and Unitarian minister. This is what he said: "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends toward justice." Parker's words, written and spoken in 1853, when slavery was still a reality against which he was working, acknowledge how limited our view is, but also the need for us to act. Michael Denzel Smith writes, "As an abolitionist and Christian, of course Parker is sure the arc bends toward justice, or else his work and faith must both be called into question. But his uncertainty about the moral universe is what makes his strong faith a necessity. For Parker, there is no guarantee. That, he sees clearly, of the moral universe doing as he wishes. It is only through his own conscience, and thereby his own actions, that justice will be achieved." In other words, the arc doesn't bend on its own. It needs our action to bend it. Now, when I think of dashed expectations, I think of one that resonates strongly for me. The expectation of safety. This past week was the 18th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And it was so odd to listen to the radio Wednesday morning and hear the voices of young people who don't remember that day at all. Who don't remember a time when we felt relatively safe and secure from terrorism. Who don't remember getting on an airplane without having to take off their shoes or walk through a metal detector or a body scanner, or without putting their liquids in those little bottles. Those of us who do remember those days have a strong memory of the disbelief and disequilibrium we felt on that day 18 years ago. How surreal it was to watch those planes hit the towers over and over again as they replayed it on the news. You remember watching that? For weeks, every time it came on the television, I would break down in tears. How strong the expressions of worldwide solidarity with the U.S. were. Remember that? Until we went to war, not just with Afghanistan, but Iraq. How easily the Patriot Act passed. Yeah? An effort to make sure that our intelligence could detect future terrorist acts that some argued went too far in terms of violating privacy. Our former expectation that while other parts of the world were dangerous, we're safe here on American soil. That expectation has been dashed. We've adjusted to this new reality and all the extra precautions it requires in airports and stadiums. Who knows how many acts of terror might have happened without those precautions? We'll never know. But this is the new reality. We went through that period of disappointment and disequilibrium, and 18 years later, we live in this new normal. So there are at least two ways to deal with the disappointment and disequilibrium of dashed expectations. We can either hold on to our old expectations, hoping, perhaps against hope, that the world will conform to our expectations. Or we can become accustomed to the new way of the world, the new normal, accepting it as it is. But I'd like to suggest another possibility, especially in light of what's happening in the week ahead. Action. Stephen mentioned that part of his dashed expectations has to do with the new reality of our world, near certainty that regions of the world will be inhospitable in a few decades due to climate change. As a child of the 60s, I grew up understanding the dangers of pollution and the need for us to work to preserve the quality of our air and water. I remember my father driving me to school in the morning. We grew up in Rogue Valley in Southern Oregon. And we'd look across the valley and see this layer of smog. And he grew up in that valley. And he was so saddened by the smoke that was created by the lumber mills in my hometown. It's better now. The sky is clear. I remember celebrating Earth Day and the successes we were making for the environment. But back then, we hadn't realized the extent of our impact on the environment. We didn't know that global warming wouldn't result in the catastrophic effects we're already seeing today. The melting polar ice caps. Anybody seen pictures of polar bears recently? The sea level rise. The extinction of animals. More intense hurricanes and droughts and wildfires. So I have to take a step back. Last year when I visited my dad, you couldn't see across the valley because of the wildfire smoke. And now it's no longer theoretical. We're seeing the impacts now, and so are our children. And we are being led by the children. Last year, a Swedish teenager named Greta Thunberg started a movement by not going to school on Fridays so that she could sit in front of the parliament building to demand that her nation respond to the climate crisis. Soon, students in over 100 cities across the world followed her example. And this Friday, in anticipation of a UN meeting on climate, at which Thunberg will speak, we can all join the movement by participating in the global climate strike. Anybody heard of it? Oh, good. Ours will be happening on the drill field at Virginia Tech at noon this Friday. I saw an article in the New York Times that talked about how Greta got from Sweden to New York. She sailed. Here's the mission of the Youth Climate Strike. We, the youth of America, are striking because the science says we have just a few years to transform our energy system, reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and prevent the worst effects of climate change. We are striking because our world leaders have yet to acknowledge, prioritize, or properly address our climate crisis. We are striking because marginalized communities across our nation, especially communities of color, disabled communities, and low-income communities, are already disproportionately impacted by climate change. We are striking because if the social order is disrupted by our refusal to attend school, then the system is forced to face the climate crisis and enact change. With our futures at stake, we call for radical legislative action to combat climate change and its countless detrimental effects on the American people. We are striking for the Green New Deal, for a fair and just transition to a 100% renewable economy, and for ending the creation of additional fossil fuel in infrastructure. Additionally, we believe the climate crisis should be declared a national emergency because we are running out of time. Unitarian Universalist ministers across the country are encouraging their congregations this morning to join in the strike this Friday, because that's the only way we can have an impact, by joining forces to demand change. I just love the idea that when we go out on the drill field on Friday, there will be thousands of Unitarian Universalists doing the same thing in their hometowns. Earlier, I spoke about how the youth of our movement inspire me with hope, and how disheartening it is to think that they may not be able to expect the same future I did when I was their age. Greta Thunberg, who has become just one of many strong and powerful voices for the youth of this planet, has something to say about hope. She said, "Adults keep saying we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I she goes on, I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. I want you to act like your house is on fire because it is. So, if you can make it to the drill field at noon this Friday, that will be one small action you can take. The event on Facebook encourages us to wear blue and green. And if you can't make it to this particular action, then you can get involved in any number of environmental action groups here in the New River Valley. You can join Bill over there, who's trying to get straws booted out of all our restaurants. Many of these groups will be participating in the annual Sustainable Blacksburg events this week, culminating in the prayer walk. Talk to Kimberly about it after the service. It may not seem like much, but it's something. In closing, I'd like to share a reading by Rebecca Solnit. She writes, Nathan Sharansky, who spent 9 years in a gulag for his work with Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov, remember those names? Recalls his mentor saying, they want us to believe there's no chance of success, but whether or not there's hope for change is not the question. If you want to be a free person, you don't stand up for human rights because it will work, but because it is right. We must continue living as decent people. Solnit goes on, right now, living as decent people means every one of us with resources taking serious climate action or stepping up what we're already doing. Taking action is the best way to live in conditions of crisis and violation, for your spirit and your conscience, as well as for society. It's entirely compatible with grief and horror. You can work to elect climate heroes while being sad. There are no guarantees, but just as Sakharov and Sharansky probably didn't imagine that the Soviet Union would dissolve itself in the early 1990s, so we can anticipate that we don't know exactly what will happen and how our actions will shape the future. She goes on, the histories of change that have made me hopeful are often about small groups that seem at the outset unrealistic in their ambition. Knowing that we don't know isn't grounds for confidence, but it is fuel against despair, which is a form of certainty. And this future is as uncertain as it's ever been. For your soul, do something. So as we're faced with dashed expectations for safety, for security, for a place to live and flourish, we can hold tightly to those expectations, even when they may never be fulfilled. We can adjust our expectations so that we can live into a new reality. Or we can act in response to that changed reality, even when our actions seem small. We can look to our youth for inspiration and to others who have acted in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds. So may it be, and blessed be. I invite you to take the hand of someone near you. In the week ahead, listen for that youthful vision, that new prophetic voice. Let us live into the promise of what we can do together. Amen, and blessed be.